Well, if we're not careful, when we read a passage as Daniel just did, or particularly that passage, it could, in front of us, look quite unremarkable. You may have been thinking that as he was reading it, which is simply this very simple truth to this passage tonight, which is Jesus is our high priest, and that Jesus is the high priest that we need. And you might be thinking, okay then. And if we think it's unremarkable, then it would explain why there's a problem in the modern church that lies at the heart of why attendance for so many is so sporadic. Now, CPC is better than what is normal, not that that's necessarily a great thing. And if I remember when I was thinking about coming here, speaking to a friend and saying, I'm looking at they've done some report and it says how many come in the morning and how many come in the evening, and it used to be almost the same. At one stage, I think it was higher in the evening than the morning back in the day. And someone said, it's Presbyterians, they're just two Sunday people, aren't they? And it doesn't mean anything. But perhaps it's just duty we do it. And it may be, that may be true, you may be here for a second time, some of you, out of just duty, what will the rest think if I don't? And it may be, therefore, that we don't get as excited about church as perhaps we should. Or when we're at home by ourselves and we sit down to read the Bible and pray, and to be honest, I can think of more exciting things to do, you might think. Now, why is that? Well, when we read a passage like this, it just seems so unremarkable. It's a bit like saying, Hugo is tall. Now, Hugo says that I pick on him anyway, so I will. So when we say Hugo is tall, it is a totally unremarkable statement. And it's unremarkable for two reasons. Firstly, he is tall, but he's not what I'd call documentary tall. You know, the 6'5" man is not going to sell a documentary. It's not comment worthy tall, is he? He's just relative compared to us. And in Holland, he's what they call average. And the second reason why it's an unremarkable comment is that we already know that, because he's relatively taller than us, we've stood next to him, we think, oh, he's a bit taller than me. So saying he's tall is just so unremarkable. It's not that someone's now going, I'd never noticed how freakishly tall he is until you pointed that out. We've all noticed it, but it's not that remarkable. So it's both unremarkable, but obvious. Not tall enough to be documentary worthy, but tall enough that we would have noticed by now. So when we come to this passage and we say, Jesus is our priest, the one that you need, you go, okay, fair enough. Now, so far, as we've gone through the book of Hebrews, we've established some things like Jesus is far above the angels. Again, we sort of went, so what? And we needed to think why that was significant. And also, we've established that Jesus is our prophet, priest, and king. And from the end of chapter 4 and through most of the book, the focus now is going to be on Jesus as our better high priest of a better covenant. And we think, okay then, I'll go and read something else in the Bible. And when the writer says Jesus is our prophet and king, we get it, because we go, okay, I can see why that matters. Jesus is the greater prophet. He reveals God to us perfectly. And finally, well, I can see my need for that. I'd better listen to him. Jesus is our king. Oh, well, I better submit to him then. But when we say, we're not always quite sure why we need a priest. So we might therefore be coming at this from the wrong angle. Because I tend to ask the question, why is it meaningful for me that Jesus is my priest? Rather than thinking, why is it meaningful to God that Jesus is my priest? Now notice something about the context for a second. Hugo preached on the end of chapter 4 last week. And then we'll go on to look at verse 11 onwards next week. And they're both very heavy on application. So the bit that Hugo looked at had two applications. End of verse 14, hold firm. Start of 16, approach with confidence. They're positive things to do. And then verse 11 onwards is a negative thing about drifting and so on. And you've got to take the warnings. And between that is this passage, that Jesus is the priest that you need. So how do you hold firm and draw near and not drift? Well, through Jesus, the priest that you need. But the writer, as he writes this, assumes that you are very familiar with the Old Testament, and I'm guessing that perhaps we're not. So as Daniel read this, what should have happened, because you're so familiar with Leviticus, you would have gone, oh, wow, oh yeah, of course, that's why it's amazing, because of that bit in Leviticus. And you'd be going, not that sure in Leviticus. Rather, we're going, okay, so Jesus is our high priest that we need. So we're just going to look at this for a little while, a bit about old covenant worship. And I'm going to spend a bit of time here. So for those who have not been to CPC before, what we normally do is look at the passage and sort of unpack it, see what it's getting at and why it matters to us. And so I'm doing something slightly different at the moment. And for those of you who are normally here, you're beginning to panic in about 5 minutes' time as to why am I spending so long and I haven't got anywhere near the passage yet. It's okay. Once I've done this, the passage will all be very obvious. The text all becomes quite straightforward. So let's think about old covenant worship. In Genesis 2, God makes a covenant with Adam, which is do this and live, don't do this and die. And in that covenant, there's no provision for what's going to happen if the covenant is broken. Genesis 3, the covenant is broken and humanity is doomed. But there is grace. God does not destroy humanity. There's a covenant with Noah and creation to preserve, and then there's this special covenant with Abraham. Sometimes we call it covenant of grace or promise. And when we thought about that, we did a Bible overview on Thursdays, we thought about that there's one covenant from Abraham through to the end, but there's like covenant upgrades. Now, I've just done an upgrade with my windows, and covenant upgrades are like that, apart from they're always an improvement. Windows 10 is the jury's out. But what you have with these covenant upgrades that God keeps on kind of adding more to the covenant. The covenant is essentially the same, but there's just we move on in God's plan and progress. So there's a significant covenant upgrade in Exodus 20 where you get the Ten Commandments. And God makes a covenant with Moses, or with a nation, but through Moses, and the nation of Israel is established. And now there's a system for dealing with sin. There's sort of hints that that would be the case before that in Genesis, that's implied, but now it's explicit. In the chapter after the Ten Commandments, it's spelt out, and in Leviticus, you get the detail. And there's a system now for approaching God, for sinful people to come to God. Now, notice something that's really important that nearly all Christians get wrong. That's a bold statement, isn't it? But we often get wrong. Who provided the system in the Old Testament for being put right with God? God provided the system. So often we read the Old Testament and we read about these sacrifices and the bit where the priest gets the blood and he sprinkles it on the people and on the altar and you think, what a mess. And it seems to us primitive and like they've got hold of the wrong end of the stick because it's so different in the New Testament. Or often we think the Old Testament is about works, but that's not the case. The Old Testament is very clear from start to finish that God provides a gracious means for being with his people. He is holy, they are not. And the sacrificial system allows him to be with them. So he can now come to them and they can draw close to him. So it was a privilege to be an Israelite. And the Psalms talk about how wonderful it is to be in the temple. So it's great being in the temple, better a day there than 1,000 elsewhere. Now, how did it work? Well, there are various features about this system. There's a place. At first it's the tabernacle, and then later it's the temple in the capital, Jerusalem. There was special furniture, there were priests, and there were sacrifices. So there's a place, and here's a diagram of the tabernacle, but the temple's a very similar layout. So as the Israelites wandered in the desert, this was at the center of them. So they had each tribe camped around the tabernacle, and the tabernacle was in the middle. It's clear as you look to Israel that they thought God lived in the middle of them. And so God lives in their midst, and when they have the temple, God lives in the capital. God lives there, and God rules from there. And there was a very specific layout. So the temple is decorated in a way that reminds the people of Eden. So it's like coming into God, where God originally had lived with people. And we notice here there's different levels, and you do things to come into your court. So you start from the outside, you walk through the gate, and there's a series of things you do that get to the more holy place. And so you, as you come in, you make an offering at the altar, and the priest can go into the holy place, and the high priest into the most holy place. The most holy of the holy of holies is separated from everything else by a curtain, and on the curtain is embroidered an angel. So if you remember the end of Genesis 3, the angel guards the way back to the garden. And here, symbolically, you've got an angel stopping the way to where God is. And in the Holy of Holies is the ark, as in it just that just means a box. And in it is the Ten Commandments, the broken Ten Commandments, the broken covenant document. And then sacrifices are laid over that. So symbolically, the idea that they are covered, the broken covenant is covered from God's view. And the cover of the ark has two angels whose wings meet, and it says that God, so to speak, is enthroned above where their wings meet. Now, of course, the Old Testament teaches that God is everywhere. He's not like he had a house and didn't know what was going on in New Zealand or something. He was everywhere, but he was especially present, enthroned above the ark, in the middle of where his people lived. So God dwells at the center of his people, but they can only get so close. So God will, because he's holy, being in the center of them, they will die. So they have to do these sacrifices all the time. And to come close and into his temple, they had to do stuff. And there in the temple was a load of furniture, each for a special function in this drawing near process. So there's an altar near the gate, that's the way in through sacrifice. And central is the ark and God's throne. And there's the in that is the covenant, the deal, the promise between God and his people. And then there is the priest. I'm not expecting you to be able to read that. That's just the best thing I can get on Google Images. So there's the priest. And he had to be a descendant of Aaron, and that was rotated. They were chosen by lot, so the idea that God is sovereign over the final choice. And they had special clothing. Their undergarment was made so there would be no sign of sweat, because sweat's a sign of the fall. They had bare feet, and there are a couple of reasons why that could be. One is the idea that when you stood in front of a king, you took your shoes off. I don't know what kings had against shoes, but that's what they did. Also, the idea that the ground after the fall is cursed, but the tabernacle ground is called holy ground, so they can put their bare feet on because it's not cursed ground. Exodus 28 verse 4 says that the garments are there to give them dignity and honor. So regardless of the person, the office they hold has dignity and honor. And on their shoulders, the thing holding up their sort of tunic, and on their breast, on the plate there, they have these stones with each of the tribes of Israel engraved on it. So the idea that over their hearts, as they stand before God in the Holy of Holies, is the names of the people of God. And there's various other features about that picture that we don't have to go into now. But the point is, they had this particular clothing, particular process as well, to go about their duties. If they did not stick to them, they literally dropped dead before God. If they went into the Holy of Holies not properly prepared, they dropped dead. And their job was to represent God to the people, in particular by teaching them, and they represented the people to God by performing sacrifices and prayers. Now today, the role of a minister or an elder overlaps with the priest. Paul talks about that in 1 Corinthians 9, those who make their living in the way I'm doing this compared to those at the altar, but they're not quite equivalent, they're not quite the same. So the New Testament only talks about priests in reference to this Old Testament role. They never refer to ministers or elders with that word. And Hebrews is going to go on to explain why. And then there are all the sacrifices. There were lots of different kinds. There's the Day of Atonement, is especially significant. That's in Leviticus 16. And there's the daily sacrifices in the morning and the evening. There were fellowships and thanks offerings. There was the tithe, where they give a tenth of their income. And also there was incense. They had a very specific recipe, skillfully made, that was only allowed to be used. It specifies it can be only used in the tabernacle. You couldn't say, oh, that smells lovely, I'll have that for my tent at home. You weren't allowed to. It was only for the tabernacle, so the tabernacle had a distinct smell. So as you walked in, the closer you got to the Holy of Holies, so the smell increased. So even the smell of the tabernacle is distinct and holy. It was forbidden for use anywhere else. That's a very potted view. I know probably Alistair came out in a sweat from old brethren days where they'd spend 8 weeks looking at the tabernacle. We're not going to do that. What does it teach us? There's some things are always true from that. So we think, oh, that's just in the Old Testament. There's probably hundreds of things that are always true from that. But here's just six that I've thought of. People must not directly approach God's presence. That's the opposite to what we say as evangelicals, isn't it? It was true, and it's still true. People must not directly approach God's presence. Rather, God provides a mediator as their representative. 2, forgiveness is costly. You do not take it lightly. If you do, speak to me afterwards. You do not take it lightly when you kill an animal. You pick some like lamb along and stick it, slit its throat. You don't take that lightly. And you take a degree of care for the animal to nurture it and so on. And it costs money. It would be a significant financial outlay to people, especially when you add up all the sacrifices they made. Third thing is, a sacrifice can only be offered by a priest who's been appointed by God. Fourth, if the right sacrifice has been offered in the right way, by faith, then the people can be certain about their forgiveness as God promised. Fifth thing, similarly, is that atonement, that's the covering of the sin, which results in forgiveness by God and fellowship with him, is an external objective reality. It's an external objective reality. That means it's not about that they felt forgiven, it is that they were forgiven, regardless of how they felt about it. And the sixth thing is the whole system of priests and sacrifices is God's gracious gift to his people by which he keeps them in fellowship with himself. So all this Old Testament stuff is not wrong. It's not about working yourself to God, and it's not imperfect either. They worked. In fact, all these things are still and will always be true. Now, when you go, but what about that bit in Isaiah when he moans about God, you know, complains about the way that they approach him? It's because they do it as if this could be done automatically without faith, or with a load of, you know, they go to the temple, but they're sinning at home, and all those kind of things. All these things are still true. However, the Mosaic covenant that we've been thinking about is a shadow of the heavenly realities. So Hebrews 5 is just the start, which is going to be opened up in the rest of Hebrews, of opening that up to us, explaining that as good and as gracious and as God-given as the covenant of Moses was, there has been a very significant covenant upgrade in Jesus that we've got to embrace. And all these other things, good, gracious and effective as they are, were pointing towards bigger realities in Jesus. Now, these 6 points are still true, so with those in mind, let's come and look at Hebrews 5. And I'm going to be much quicker now, I think. So the first thing is that the qualifications of a priest. And what he's just saying is, these are the qualifications of a priest, and look, Jesus meets them. But in a more pure way and in a more useful way. So the qualifications of a priest are in verses 1 to 4, and we'll see in verse 2 it's that they're able to sympathise, in verse 4 that they're appointed by God. And Jesus is appointed by God, verses 5 to 6, and Jesus is able to sympathise in verses 7 to 10. So let's zero in on them a little bit. I've put the main points there in bold. So the first thing to notice is that this is the qualifications of a priest, but the first thing is, what does he do? Verse 1, every high priest is selected from among men and is appointed to represent them in matters related to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. So it says he's to represent God to the people and vice versa, and to offer sacrifices. And then the qualification is that he sympathizes. It says he deals gently with them, just as Jesus did, but we'll see Jesus does it better. And notice there's a difference there at the end of verse 2, is he is subject to weakness. And so verse 3, sacrifices are offered for the priest. So before a priest can deal with your sin, he needs to deal with his own sin. So there's sacrifices and a purification rite, first of all, for him. Now we'll see in a moment that's not needed for Jesus, because he has no sin. And then the second qualification is that he's appointed by God. So Aaron didn't assume this role. God appointed him to it. And in the future, from Aaron onwards, the future priests, they had to be from the right family, and then they had to be appointed by lot to show that God chose them. And extreme cases, people from outside that family performed that role, for example, Samuel, but each time it was clear that God appointed them. And both of these qualifications apply to Jesus, but without sin, hence the supreme confidence we had from last week, draw near. So Jesus is appointed by God, verses 5 to 6. The writer's saying, just like other priests, Jesus is also appointed by God. He did not assume or presume to take the role. He was humble like Aaron. And he proves it with two quotes from the Psalms that at first we might think, I'm not sure how that does prove it. But let's look at them. The first is Psalm 2, which we've seen already in Hebrews, that show that Jesus Christ is the Christ of Psalm 2. He's the divine Son and King. He will defeat God's enemies. The people who laughed at him, well, he will defeat them. And you must make peace with him or be destroyed. And the second quote is from Psalm 110. And most of it sounds familiar to Psalm 2. So the Lord, in capitals, that's Yahweh, Jehovah, God's name, makes Lord, in lower case letters, the Christ, sit at his right hand, that's in the place of authority, while he's defeating his enemies. And so it's saying that God extends Christ's rule, and all resistance against him is futile. But in that, we get this bit in verse 6, you are a priest forever in the order of Melchizedek. So in Psalm 110, the Christ is not just the all-conquering king, but he's also the priest. He is a priest-king. Now, so he's not a Levite-style priest like Aaron, but of a different order. Now, I won't go into Melchizedek now because he's going to come up in a couple of weeks. But all we need to know for now is that there's this guy called Melchizedek who is a king and a priest at the same time. He predates Levi, and also his king job is the king of Jerusalem, which is David's city, the city of the Christ. Now, we'll think about him later, another week. But Christ is appointed by God as king and priest. The one who you must make peace with, the king, who's God incarnate, is also the one who does the peacemaking. The other thing is that Jesus is able to sympathize with us in verses 7 to 10. So the priest had to be gentle with the sinners. They've got to understand them in order to be able to help and direct them. So they were meant to be directive, but to be understanding as they did so. And Jesus qualifies for this perfectly. It's interesting, I was at ARUCU on Friday night, and I was doing something about this, and they got this immediately. I was really impressed. That what most people think is, surely, if Jesus is sinless, he doesn't understand my struggle with sin. Well, in fact, it means he understands it more. He can do a better job than the priests under the old system. Because our understanding, he understands our temptation better, precisely because he had no sin. If you look at verse 7, it says he cried out with tears. Now that could be a reference to him weeping over Jerusalem. Could be in his compassion for the lost. It could be about being at Gethsemane. But we see, just as the high priest in the Old Testament had the names of the tribes on their over their heart as they entered the tabernacle, Jesus very much bears us on his heart as he goes into the heavenly holy of holies. Now, so far in Hebrews, the emphasis has been very much on Jesus' divinity. He is very God. But here, the emphasis is that he is like us. He is able to sympathize. Now, a couple of odd features here that you may have noticed. It says, he learned obedience and was made perfect, which suggests that before he was made perfect, he was imperfect. And before he learned obedience, implies that he must have been disobedient. And that these ideas come up again in Hebrews. But the idea is that Jesus, eternal God and King, yet subjected himself to his Father's rule on earth, perfectly obeyed God's law, and in obediently following God's plan, he suffered. So Jesus learned obedience that way. And we've seen before that perfect in the Bible often means complete. So prior to the cross and resurrection, God's plan was perfect, but its execution was not perfect because it hadn't happened yet. And so we see here, and the emphasis in verse 10, that Jesus is not just qualified as a priest, but he is far, far superior a priest, because he carries us on his heart even more than Aaron did. He loves us more than Aaron or the other priests did. And he sacrificed not a lamb, but he sacrificed himself. He is the priest and king that rules us and represents us and makes peace with us. He also is more obedient, meaning he has more identity and sympathy with us. You might be thinking, how can he do that? If he hasn't sinned and I've sinned, how can he identify with us in that way? Oscar Wilde said, he has some great one-liners, doesn't he? But Oscar Wilde said, I can resist anything except temptation. Now, why do we find temptation so hard? Well, we may find it so hard, but eventually temptation always leaves us. It leaves us in one of two ways. Either the thing tempting us leaves, it goes away, or we give into it. Either way, we've dealt with temptation. But Jesus never sinned. So he's actually the most tempted person in history. because it means that he experienced more temptation than anyone else, because the temptation never left and he never gave in. Because most temptations he experienced would have just been there all the time. So when we speak to a Christian friend or an elder about a temptation, and sometimes you just think, you don't understand, do you? You don't understand what I'm going through. Now, usually, we probably do understand more than you think. But it's true, maybe that temptation passed us by in one way or another. But Jesus endured temptation continually. If there's one person who understood temptation, it's the Lord Jesus. And yet, he still deals with us gently. He doesn't go, well, look, 33 years, no sin, loads of temptation. Which problem? He deals with us gently. Now, are you still thinking this is an unremarkable passage? Hopefully not, but here's some application as we finish. And there's probably a lot, and this sets us up for the rest of Hebrews. But not only is it remarkable, this passage, but there's lots to think about as a result. Now, the big idea in Hebrews is don't drift, and there are different ways in which we can do that, and he keeps on providing preventatives. So don't drift, but make use of your high priest. Now, sometimes evangelicals talk, although we can just walk up to God, you know, because God is my mate, isn't he? And others feel that he's not worthy because he's so holy and I'm so not. And maybe tonight you're struggling with sin and guilt. What are you going to do? Are you going to struggle alone and stop relating to God because you know you've got an idea of who he is and who you are, and so it's just all a bit embarrassing now to face him? Are you going to talk to a Christian friend, maybe even an elder? Well, that's not a bad idea. I guess that's what we're around for. But how about going to Jesus Christ, your high priest? Now, we saw earlier what the Old Testament taught us about priests and sacrifices. You need a high priest to intercede, to sacrifice, who understands and who's called by God. And the good news is that you have one. And the one that you have is not limited by geography or time. Who understands, and unlike the Old Testament priests, his work is finished. They had to keep on having a new priest. They had to keep on offering sacrifices. What do they do the next day? Offer more sacrifices. And that's why it looks like we can just wander in. It's sort of a half-truth, because God has, through Christ, God has made it so accessible, so easy, it would appear. And often we overemphasize God's accessibility and say things like, well, talking to God, praying, it's just like using a mobile. And yes, God is very accessible and has much better reception than at least my provider, but only because Jesus is our high priest. And at great cost, he made the sacrifice. So last week we thought, draw near with confidence. But where to? Well, where did it say last week? It said, to the very throne room of heaven. You draw near to the very throne room of heaven through Christ. And that means we should. Also means we should obey. It talks here a lot about his obedience. To benefit from this, Jesus, our brother, so in chapter 2 of Hebrews, and in the mornings looking at Joseph, we notice that Jesus has made us his brothers. We need to imitate him. We need to learn obedience through suffering and see that that's a process. And as we struggle, he is able to help us, especially at the end of chapter 4. He understands. He really understands. He understands better than you do what you are going through. And finally is something about how we view worship. Now imagine, if you can, that you are one of the first readers of the book of Hebrews. You might be a Jewish Christian, or you would certainly know Jewish people. And the temple's still functioning at this time. So you see the temple, and you see the ritual, you see the special clothing that the priests have, you see the beauty of the temple and of the ritual, and it's very visual and tactile way of seeing God's grace in action and acted out. There's even a distinct smell that every time you go to a temple, you go, temple time, this is God's place. And you can see what they're doing, and it seems special. Contrast to this new thing called Christianity. It's meant to be the fulfillment of all that. And there you are, probably persecuted, probably meeting in someone's house or in the woods, and someone reads the Bible, and someone else gives a sermon, or you have a little discussion about it. You sing a few psalms, probably without instruments, and some people from time to time have tried to write a hymn, and you give that a go, and a few people pray. And it's just a bit lame. And the problem they experience, and probably why a lot of people think Hebrews is written, is because the Christians are going, this is hard and looks a bit rubbish, and the temple thing is amazing. Because the temple thing looks real and it's tangible. And this just looks, well, this just looks like this. And Hebrews is saying to them, your high priest is Jesus. And do you remember in chapter 2, who stands among the church? He stands in the church and says, here are my brothers. When we gather as the church, Jesus stands with and says to God the Father, here's my brothers. The high priest, offering a better sacrifice of a better covenant, stands among us and calls us to be with him. So what are you doing here? Well, later in Hebrews, he will say, you're not standing in the temple in Jerusalem. You're not even standing at Mount Sinai where God made it quake, but you're there in withstanding with the heavenly multitude yourself. The first readers were being tempted back to the temple, and the writer is saying, no, don't go back to the temple. That was good and God-given, but it's had its purpose. No, look at this, is what you're doing is amazing. It's like walking away from the destination and going back to the waiting room. Now, that's them then. Why does this matter to us? Because the temple, God conveniently and helpfully for us, had it knocked down. So as Christians started to get buildings and stopped being persecuted, they tried to make their buildings and their services recreate heaven. And it looked very Old Testament. So priests wore special clothing, offered what they called sacrifices, and they lay their buildings out like the temple with a bit that the plebs sit in and the bit where the important people sit and the really holy bit you can't see. And at the Reformation, they stripped that back and they just basically said, what you need here is something to keep the rain off, a pulpit and a table for communion, and off we go. And the reformers were rediscovering these truths. And I think I need to reform some of the things that I've said and what we often say as evangelicals. For example, we no longer need priests. Oh, yes, we do. But there's only one priest that we need, our high priest, who is Jesus Christ. And we very much need him, because you can't just walk into God's presence. You need him to take you there. Or another thing is, religion is man coming to God, and Christianity is God going to man. Sort of. But perhaps better to say Christianity is true religion. And in true religion, God comes to man in order to take him back to God. To take us to where he is, spiritually now even. And what you may be thinking in your mind as I'm saying this is, oh, this sounds a bit like Roman Catholicism, Eastern Orthodoxy, Anglo-Catholicism, things like that. But actually, we're just as prone to this stuff. There's plenty of modern evangelical ways of doing this, where mystically we try to create an ambience, and again, something that seems tangible, that says, oh, that felt like we really met with God then. Now, of course, when it comes to things like music, it's not compulsory that we make it dull. We can do things well and beautifully. But there seems to be a problem with either over-familiarity, this is so ordinary what we're doing here, it's just like using a mobile, and the other extreme is to go, well, we've got to make it as special as we can so that people think that we've tricked them somehow into thinking that we've met with God. Rather, what Hebrews is saying is that what we are doing, what we're doing now, is amazing. It is absolutely amazing. You're approaching God the Father through the high priest, Jesus Christ, who died in your place, the king and the priest who stands among us. And you kind of look around, you think, well, it needs a lick of paint. It's a bit smelly in the winter. And, you know, Jesus Christ stands among us. What we're doing is amazing. We don't have to conjure anything up. Whoever leads or preaches or however you feel, Jesus is no more or no less among us. So we need to embrace the enormity of what Jesus has done and the privilege that we have and the accessibility that we can draw near in a very straightforward way. But it makes it no less a big thing or no less a privilege. So it's not just like using a mobile at one end. And neither do we need complex buildings and special people and that sort of thing. But we approach God the Father through the high priest, Jesus Christ, who stands here among his church. And the application last week is, therefore, we hold fast and we draw near. And next week we'll see the warnings. Why would we drift? If we're aware of what we're doing, when we pray alone at home, we have access to God. When we gather with the local church, our high priest stands with us and takes us into the Holy of Holies, but not one in Jerusalem, but the Holy of Holies in heaven itself. Let's pray. Father, we thank you for the wonder of what Jesus has done for us in removing our sin, in becoming like us, and in drawing us, not just coming to us, but then drawing us to you. That he stands among us and says, here are my brothers. Please help us to get a greater understanding of what it means to meet with you. That On the one hand, we would take that great privilege to draw near, but that we don't draw near lightly, but that great cost, that great sacrifice has been met by another, and we give you thanks for him. Amen.